this is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson visiting KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. California has a lot to decide in the midterms. Who will be the next governor? And will the state's congressional races contribute to a predicted blue wave across the nation? There's also renewed political energy on both sides of the aisle now that Brett Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court. How might Republicans and Democrats use that to their advantage? Joining us today here at KQED to discuss these and all the big stories in the week's news across the country is Lily Jamali, the co-host and correspondent for the station's statewide news magazine, The California Report. Lily, welcome to 1A.
Great to be here and welcome back to KQED.
Thank you very much. Joining us from our home base in D.C. is political journalist and sometimes fill-in host Todd Zwillick. Hey, Todd.
Hi, Josh.
And Shane Harris covers intelligence and national security for The Washington Post. Good to have you back, Shane.
Hi from afar, Joshua.
Let's begin with the weather, which made big news this week. You know, it's been more than 50 years since the United States had a storm like Hurricane Michael. Florida's panhandle bore the brunt of the damage. That's where it made landfall. Many beachfront homes are in pieces, splinters at best, and a number of water rescues are underway. More than a million power customers in Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia are disconnected, and the death toll rose overnight to at least 11. The director of FEMA, Brock Long, or the administrator of FEMA, spoke to CNN's John Berman this morning on New Day.
What's the biggest challenge you and your teams are facing this morning?
Well, access to all the areas is one thing. Search and rescue is where we are hyper-focused this morning. But simultaneously, what we're trying to do is assess roadways and bridges to make sure that we can get, you know, teams, commodities, and equipment into the areas that were hardest hit. The hospital system near Panama City, in and around Panama City, took a hit too. So we have to stabilize the health and medical capabilities that are there. Over 30,000 workers from around the United States have been pre-staged to try to work as quickly as possible to get the power back on. But here again, it's all about access. We got to make sure that it's safe to travel down roadway corridors and get in there to start rebuilding the power grid, which could take a very long time at this point.
That's FEMA Administrator Brock Long speaking this morning on CNN. He also expressed some frustration with Floridians who did not mind the updates to the building codes, which were updated in 2001. Pretty clear to see which homes were up to code and which were not. You can tell which homes were up to code because they were still standing when Michael is gone. Todd Zwillick, talk about the kind of pressure that FEMA is under with this recovery effort, especially considering that these kinds of strong storms may well become more frequent in the near future.
A devastating storm, huge sections. You saw some of the drone coverage and aerial photos. Entire sections of Mexico Beach in Florida essentially erased. A devastating storm, even if the death toll is not the horrible numbers that we heard from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Belated numbers, by the way. So you asked about the government and their response. FEMA has, of course, fallen under increased scrutiny since Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and quite appropriately so. Many of the shortfalls from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico don't seem to have fallen squarely on FEMA's shoulders. And indeed, the federal government in this case, I think, managed to skirt a lot of the responsibility for a response that outraged many Americans, and certainly many Americans in Puerto Rico. I think once the storm assessment is done here, Joshua, one of the things that you're going to see is sort of the after damage assessment, and then lawmakers on Capitol Hill asking for disaster relief money. There will be an opportunity in December in the lame duck session for another appropriations fight. That'll be a fight, but embedded in that fight, we'll see what kind of will the Republican Congress has to send relief money through FEMA largely down to help Florida and Georgia and the Carolinas recover.
Shane Harris, what have we heard from the president so far on Hurricane Michael, the devastation and also the recovery effort? What's he been saying?
Well, he has largely praised it. And of course, he spent a lot of time in Florida and had good things to say about the resiliency and the professionalism of emergency management and first responders in Florida. He knows well, of course, as Todd was just saying, what the outrage was to the response with Hurricane Maria. And previous to this, of course, President Trump inspired so much outrage and pushback when he question whether the death toll that now stands at more than 3,000 people in Puerto Rico was accurate and accused Democrats of making up the number. So he will have good things to say as long as the response goes well. And really for any president, FEMA and the whole disaster response works well when you can depoliticize it as much as possible and really let the professionals take over with the response. And that appears to be what's happening now here as well. It's also going to be, though, the aftermath. You heard Brock Long talking about rebuilding the power grid. There are houses that, if they are even rebuilt, will have to be completely rebuilt. Now that the brunt of the storm is over, it was very quick and very powerful, few dead, but the cleanup here is massive. If that is slow, if people aren't getting the money, the relief that they need, if there are problems with claim adjustments, as there were during Hurricane Sandy, that's where it all comes back to roost for the White House.
Now, add to just the raw devastation of Hurricane Michael the conversation that many people had been having this week about the nature of climate change. This week, the UN released a major report on climate change, which came with very dire warnings for the planet. President Trump had a fairly skeptical reaction to the report's findings. Listen.
It was given to me, and I want to look at who drew it, you know, which group drew it, because I couldn't give you reports that are fabulous, and I can give you reports that aren't so good. But I will be looking at it, absolutely. What do you think?
Part of what the president said after this report came out, worth noting that the report was compiled by a consortium of scientists from around the world, one of whom we spoke to on this program this week. You'll find that program online at the1a.org. Lily Jamali, I wonder what your sense is of how, you know, the administration's response to this report might affect the way we deal with storms like this in the future.
Yeah, well, you know, as you mentioned, this is from a credible source. This is the IPCC, and they've been putting these reports out for years now. What strikes me about this one in particular is that people are actually talking about it. It seems to have penetrated that complacency barrier that we often run into when we talk about climate change.
And I'm sorry, I should say the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's this international group that's kind of under the aegis of the UN.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And the main message here is not one of pure despair, although it does outline, you know, some very scary scenarios if you see global temperatures rise, even incrementally from, you know, say 1.5 degrees Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius. But there is the sense here that you can still do something, that we can still do something about this. And, you know, California, Californians often joke we're the home of the resistance against Donald Trump. And certainly on this issue, that's been the case. To your question, Governor Jerry Brown has made the fight against climate change a signature issue. He'll joke about how he's going to be long gone by the time some of these worst case scenarios come to pass. But he's really trying to make California be seen as a leader at a time when the feds are pushing back against the science. And you heard Donald Trump, the tone that he's taken on that in that soundbite you just played.
Yeah, and in terms of being able to deal with a challenge this big, it's also worth noting that the Nobel Prize in Economics went out at the start of this week to Paul Romer and William Nordhaus. The two of them had been studying the economics of climate change. Nordhaus has endorsed a universal carbon tax. Romer's research shows that humans are innovative enough to solve a challenge even as big as climate change. So perhaps that's some reason for some hope. We are here at KQED speaking to Lily Jamali, co-host and correspondent with the California Report, political journalist Todd Zwillick, and Shane Harris of The Washington Post. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this or any of the big stories across the country that made news this week, 1A@WAMU.org. Bill wrote on our Facebook page, "I wrote out Camille at Kessler Air Force Base in 1969, so this level of destruction looks familiar." Kessler's in Mississippi, by the way. John commented on our Facebook page, "Can you please discuss the National Flood Insurance Program and how its past pattern of payouts contributes to financial losses by tacitly encouraging people who live in floodplains to stay where they are?" We actually did a program about flood insurance that I would refer you to, John, just so you can hear it in a little more depth. You'll find that online at the1a.org. But Todd Zwillick, I think it's worth noting that the policy questions around what we do with these big storms are getting more present, and it seems like more urgent, particularly with reports like the one that came out this week on climate change.
How many more devastating storms do we have to see in this country and others before Americans collectively and their leaders take this threat seriously? You had sort of the shruggy response from the president of the United States. From here inside the Beltway, responses from Republicans on Capitol Hill who were asked about the report this week, Joshua, and their responses range from dismissive to jokily dismissive, senators making jokes, I might as well sprout wings and fly to Mars. I mean, just an utter blindness on the part of some of our leaders. I'll bring you back to Professor Nordhaus. You mentioned him. He did win the Nobel Prize for endorsing the carbon tax. The IPCC says that a carbon tax now, at this point, may never get us to the point of carbon reductions that we need. And maybe there's a little bit of optimism at the base of the report, but Professor Nordhaus, I'll read you a quote because it was remarkable to me. It's hard to be optimistic, and we're actually going backward in the United States with the disastrous policies of the Trump administration. Those are the words of the man who just won the Nobel Prize for economics for his work on carbon reduction.
Before we move on from the weather and the climate, Lily, there was one more thing you wanted to drop in.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, you know, Paul Romer, the other guy who won the Nobel Prize in economics this week, talking about carbon tax as being the solution to this crisis, at least in part. And, you know, I think it's important to just recognize that sounds punitive, but I think there is a positive message that he's trying to put out there. And that is, if you commit to a tax on carbon, not only are you dealing with this issue head on, but you're also, in his view, opening up the opportunity for people to make money, investors to make money off of this. Because when money's at stake, you're always going to find alternatives. People will naturally gravitate. And the economic argument is often on carbon tax that it's bad for business. California is the fifth largest economy in the world. And Jerry Brown just signed an executive order committing the state to carbon neutrality by 2045, which I'm sure sounds crazy to people outside of the state. But that's actually very close to one of the policy prescriptions the IPCC set forth.
It's kind of crazy until you do it, really. And California is very serious about doing it.
It's very serious about doing it. You know, Paul Romer talks about the problem isn't going to be solved until you build consensus. And political will is really at the heart of that. There's really a huge divide in terms of political will, not just here, but also, you know, I just moved here from Canada. Same thing there. You have Prime Minister Justin Trudeau trying to impose a carbon tax across the country, and he's running into real opposition at the provincial level there.
Before we move on, let me get to one more comment, a few more comments on this. Not My Economy tweeted, "Why are we still talking about the credibility of science when it comes to climate change?" Good point, Not My Economy. I don't know if you listen to this program, but we are not questioning the credibility. That's kind of a done deal on this program, but I hear what you're saying. Larry tweeted, "It's frustrating to hear criticism of citizens in some of the poorest parts of Florida for not upgrading their home's ability to withstand hurricanes. They may live where other people vacation, but they're mostly stuck. This storm will expose that contrast." Shane Harris, I wonder if you could respond to Larry. On one hand, I disagree with him as a Floridian. Like, the state of Florida has programs to help you harden your home. And if you want to live in Florida, that is a basal risk of living within yards of a rising coastline. If you want to live there, you just have to absorb that. On the other hand, I totally hear where he's coming from. Like, if Mexico Beach, where the Hurricane Michael made landfall, had to be moved back from the coastline for safety's sake, the town could unincorporate. It's a tough one.
No, it is really tough. And when we're thinking about climate change in the sort of 30 to 40 year arc, Todd and I were just talking about this during the break. There are existential risks that are posed not just to communities close to the coastline, the one we're talking about today, but large cities, you know, like Miami and Florida and other places that really in the long term are going to have to make serious, profound choices about survivability, about resilience, about whether people want to continue living there. And there is an element of risk that you take, but that also has to give people some agency. And what I think is missing from the conversation about climate change is a real honest discussion about long-term risk and what the responsibility is for people living in these places and their elected leaders, both at the local and the national level. We are not having that conversation.
And Joshua, one small point just to end. Mm-hmm. If you think that risk and getting your heads around the risk for lower income or poor people here in America is something we need to think about. Americans also need to think about what some of our international leaders, generals like Colin Powell, advisors, had been saying for years. If you think it's a risk in this country, imagine what storms, increased drought, and conflict means for millions and millions of poor people around the world when they start to migrate, when they upset the relationships between countries. And that becomes not just their problem in terms of life and death, but America's problem in terms of keeping the world in order.
Let's move on to the White House, where another major official is leaving the administration. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, announced her resignation on Tuesday.
A lot of people are going to want to say there's a lot of reasons why I'm leaving. The truth is, I want to make sure that this administration, the president, has the strongest person to fight. It was a blessing to go into the UN with body armor every day and defend America. And I'll always do that. I'll never truly step aside from fighting for our country. But I will tell you that I think it's time.
Nikki Haley speaking on Tuesday about resigning as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Now, this resignation was different from some of the others we've seen in this administration because it seemed to kind of come out of nowhere by surprise. Last month, Ambassador Haley published an op-ed in The Washington Post declaring her loyalty to and respect for the president. Shane, what is your read on Nikki Haley's resignation announcement? Do we take it at face value? Is there more at play here? What do you think?
Well, there's always more at play, particularly in this White House. It was a surprise. There's no doubt about that. It was a surprise even to people in the administration. Nikki Haley also, I think, had found herself increasingly politically isolated in the power centers of foreign policy in the administration with John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and Mike Pompeo, now Secretary of State, sort of absorbing a lot of that energy. And then, of course, this administration being quite hostile to the United Nations, being UN ambassador is not necessarily the most powerful position. Nikki Haley has presidential ambitions. She said today in her meeting with Trump this week, she's not running in 2020. She plans to be campaigning for him. 2024 is not that long away. And so I think there's an element of that as well. The question of why now is a curious one that'll keep people in Washington guessing. She may have thought, get out before the midterms. There may be, if Democrats take back the House, they are going to become a subpoena factory. This administration will be under investigation relentlessly. And Nikki Haley herself is under scrutiny for private jet flights that she accepted from friends and associates. There's been some investigation into that. It might have just been that now was the time to head for the exits. And I have to say, she really does leave probably in one of the best positions of any senior Trump administration official. She's not leaving under a cloud of scandal. She won generally plaudits for her work at the UN. She was seen as a stabilizing force within an administration that many people feel needs them. And she can leave with her head held high. And I think certainly someone as smart and capable and as ambitious as Nikki Haley, this is not her swan song.
Yeah, Lily, that was exactly what I was going to ask you about, is this kind of what you read into Nikki Haley's resignation compared to some of the other turnover in the Trump administration. I mean, it's not unprecedented for a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., to serve for a year. Some serve for 3 or 4 years, some serve for 1 year. So the sheer duration of her term isn't necessarily telling, but I don't know that we view this in the same light as, say, the way that, like, Rex Tillerson left or some of the other people in the administration.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, frankly, 2 years seems like a natural timeline for somebody to serve in such a position and decide to call it quits. And Trevor Noah joked, you know, hey, at least this resignation was scandal free. So there's that. You know, it's been interesting watching a chorus of Democrats, of Democratic lawmakers praising her in the last few days, saying in some cases that they didn't have very high expectations of her going in, and they've sort of rethought that now that she's been there for 2 years and has done what they deem as a pretty good job. Having said that, the ACLU has been very critical of her tenure in this role. They say that she's undermined universal human rights and international bodies. They've criticized her for her role in the administration's pullout from UNHCR, the Human Rights Commission and UNESCO. So, you know, it's not all positive and all, you know, hugs and kisses as she's leaving.
Just taking a look at the list of previous ambassadors to the UN and, you know, the duration of the term varies. Some are a year. Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. served for like 7 years. Madeleine Albright served for 4 years. So there is a great deal of variety in terms of the durations of the term. But I wonder who we think might be serving the next term, Todd. We've heard Ivanka Trump's name thrown around. I think the president mentioned that. But do we have any idea yet as to who might be Ambassador Haley's successor?
Yes, let me knock down the biggest name for you right away, Joshua Johnson. Ivanka Trump, first daughter, was pretty quick to tweet out how honored she was to be considered, but that person will not be me. So we will not have Ambassador Ivanka Trump, at least not by her own reckoning. The biggest name that was being bandied about by the press as soon as Nikki Haley stepped down was Dina Powell, a former Deputy National Security Advisor. Dina Powell says yesterday she is staying at Goldman Sachs, where she is ensconced as an executive now and making plenty of money. People have thrown out Bob Corker's name. He's currently chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, not a Donald Trump ally. And as of January 1st, not a senator anymore. He's retiring. He's going to be looking for a job, probably hoping to make more money than he would make if he were UN ambassador. Again, those two gentlemen don't get along. But also, President Trump does have a demonstrated history of getting over it if he wants somebody to serve him. But there have been a couple of other names that have been put out as put around the beltway as well. Richard Grenell is a former spokesman at the UN, a current ambassador to Germany, I believe, and the highest ranking, I think, openly gay Republican in the administration. That's one little part of his bio. Mm-hmm. And also Brian Hook, who worked for Rex Tillerson. Rex Tillerson ousted, of course, as Secretary of State. And Brian is one of the people who managed to hang on at State and really keep his bona fides with the Trump administration. His name has been out there as well.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's move on to an op-ed that was published this week in USA Today, written by the president himself. The headline, quote, "Democrats' Medicare for All plan will demolish promises to seniors," unquote. The op-ed began by laying out the president's opposition to the Medicare proposal from Senator Bernie Sanders. Then it transitioned to a broader criticism of Democrats. He wrote in part, quote, "The truth is that the centrist Democratic Party is dead. The new Democrats are radical socialists who want to model America's economy after Venezuela," unquote. Now, other journalists quickly criticized USA Today and pounced on the paper for publishing the op-ed, pointing out that nearly every single sentence contained something false. USA Today did have an online version of the op-ed that had some fact checks in it, but that does you no good if you read a newspaper on paper. Shane Harris, I wonder what you see in terms of the strategy of the White House publishing this op-ed. It's the first of its kind. How important really is it that it was tearing down this Medicare for All proposal? And how important is it that USA Today just kind of let it run as is?
You know, there's two thoughts on this. One is there's the political lens to look through this, which is that placing it in USA Today, which has a huge circulation and has a lot, I think, probably more market penetration in places where President Trump would like to get this message across than perhaps the New York Times or my paper, the Washington Post. What you're seeing here was almost the text version of a Trump rally where he will make all kinds of assertions, falsehoods, maybe lies. We could call some of them lies. We can dissect them and categorize them. But this was really, I mean, I think my colleague at the Post, Glenn Kessler, who's the sort of the fact-checking gold standard, used that line you mentioned that nearly every sentence contains something misleading or a falsehood. In that sense, I think you can view this much more as a political document, a kind of rallying document. Then there comes the second question, which is, all right, if that's the case, what was the journalistic obligation of USA Today to push back on this? And I must say, I'm not on the editorial side, I'm on the news side, and there's a bit of a church and state separation. But if I were a media reporter, I would not be that impressed by USA Today's response to say, well, we give people a lot of leeway in their opinions. There is the old saying, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts, as Senator Moynihan said. It seemed like the leeway that USA Today was giving the president in this op-ed just ran crashing right into the wall of what the basic fact-checking is supposed to be about. So I'm still not quite understanding how the editors chose to go ahead and allow this to run in the form that it did. And it's it's frankly, it's a real embarrassment for USA Today.
And it is worth noting that on many papers, you know, on, even on the editorial team, Lily, there are fact checkers. Like, there is an editor who edits editorials to make sure that they're accurate.
They're
or at least that they're grounded in the facts.
Absolutely. You know, I think Trump recognizes that this is going to be a rallying cry for the Democrats, not just in the midterms, but looking out ahead to 2020. This is something that here in California, U.S. Senator Kamala Harris is out front on talking about it. And she's actually the first person to back Senator Sanders on this last year, at least publicly. Newsom, Gavin Newsom, who is running for governor on the Democratic ticket, immediately took to Twitter to strike down Trump's comments in this op-ed. And he talked about Trump's support for the Graham-Cassidy bill, which would have allowed insurers to charge more for pre-existing conditions. This is absolutely something that Gavin Newsom is running on. He wants a government-run healthcare system. And Trump actually called him out in Montana a couple of weeks ago on this, saying not only does Newsom want universal healthcare, he also wants it to apply to undocumented immigrants. So Trump joked he may even move here to California to get the free healthcare.
One more story we'd like to start getting into before we have to pause, and that has to do with the newest Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh. He was confirmed Saturday in a 50-48 Senate vote, sworn in as a justice over the weekend and on Monday in a ceremonial swearing-in with the justice's family by his side. Listen.
Will you please repeat after me? I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
Part of the swearing-in ceremony for the newest Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh. His confirmation to the Supreme Court comes after a months-long battle between Democrats and Republicans over that nomination. We'd like to talk more about how that confirmation has resonated across the country, and frankly, whether this fight is over. Some senators are vowing to continue that fight against Kavanaugh, so what would be their next move? Todd Zwillick, let's talk a bit about Brett Kavanaugh. We're seeing his Supreme Court nomination and confirmation heavily politicized going into the midterms. President Trump is using the issue to energize Republicans. Democrats are doing the same thing on the other side of the aisle. I wonder where we see this going, especially since Democrats, some of them, seem determined not to let the Kavanaugh confirmation go.
It seems to have had opposite effects, or at least so it seems. These numbers are a little sketchy. I want to put the proviso around what I'm about to say, that the polls are fresh and we don't know exactly what this means yet for the upcoming midterms. We will know in 4 weeks. However, it looks like now it's having an opposite effect on Senate races and House races. We've seen several Senate races, places like Tennessee, places like North Dakota, where races that seem to be closer, where the Democrat who is challenging a Republican in a red state actually had a chance of either surviving or, in the case of Tennessee, maybe picking up an open seat, to now a surge for Republicans. The Brett Kavanaugh phenomenon seems to, in Senate races, have solidified Republican base voters behind Republican candidates in most cases. And then, curiously, in House races where so many Republicans are vulnerable, I can't say that it's had the opposite effect, because I'm not sure that a Supreme Court fight has a cause and effect relationship on House races. House members don't really have much to do with Supreme Court fights, at least not in confirming them. But there doesn't seem to have been the same erosion in a lead or in Democratic support in the House. However, looking forward, and you mentioned that a lot of Democrats are promising their base that the fight isn't over on Brett Kavanaugh, not necessarily because of his ideological positions on Roe or executive power, but what his behavior was in high school and college, and more importantly, perhaps, whether he was truthful under oath in front of the Judiciary Committee and in his statements when he talked about his drinking, when he talked about his behavior in high school and college. I would look to the House, most likely. House members who may, if the numbers hold true, control the House after January. They will control the Judiciary Committee. They will control the investigations committees. They will have chairmanships. And like Shane said before, they will become subpoena factories. They will also have to respond to a base that wants Brett Kavanaugh's statements investigated. A lot of this, Joshua, comes from dissatisfaction over the extremely limited nature of that FBI background check, that week in between when Christine 2016, Blasey Ford came forward and we had that high-profile, highly emotional and remarkable hearing in front of the Judiciary Committee. The FBI really investigate? Did they get to the bottom of anything? Did they ask 10, 12, 14 people who may have been witnesses in some form to some of the alleged behavior? It appears that they didn't, and people might be relying on Democrats to take up that charge.
Lily?
I'll add to this. You know, Senator Kamala Harris is not just on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but she's also on the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. And in that capacity, she had the chance to grill FBI Director Christopher Wray on this face to face. How much intervention did the White House do in this supplemental background check? Real quick, also on ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein, her 6-year term in the Senate is up. So she's up for re-election. You can bet that this is going to come up in the debate between her and State Senator Kevin De Leon, who wants to know why she sat on that letter from Dr. Christine Blasey Ford for 2 months. And last thing I'll say is she just last night was trying to take the fight from, you know, on this SCOTUS thing to the way that Trump is trying to remake the courts writ large, talking about the Ninth Circuit Court here in California, Trump's nominations. This is a court that's been a real thorn in Trump's side. The White House just put forth three nominees there, and she didn't get to sign off on them. She's very upset about that. And Trump's administration is really breaking from tradition by not giving the home state senators any say in these picks.
I do want to see if we can leave time to talk California politics before the roundup is up, but a few more things out of D.C. we wanted to discuss, including the president stepping into the middle of the feud between Taylor Swift and Kanye West. He publicly dissed Miss Swift for endorsing two Democrats in Tennessee, and he welcomed Kanye West to the White House yesterday. Kanye wore a red Make America Great Again hat for the visit.
And we're going to have lunch. We're going to talk.
You said, I guess you know I love you.
I know. I don't want to put you in that spot. But
no, I'm standing in that spot. I love this guy right here. Let me give this guy a hug right here. I love this guy right here.
That's really nice.
Now, Kanye West was reportedly at the White House to discuss criminal justice reform. He also said yesterday that he doesn't like that liberals and shows like Saturday Night Live make the president look bad. He said the president needs to be, in his words, precious to us as Americans. We should also be clear, though, Shane Harris, Kanye seemed rather rambling during a good bit of his visit, maybe a little unhinged. He had noted that he had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I'm hesitant to dig deep in on this story. I think Kanye is easy to mock, easy to make fun of, easy to criticize. But the fact that he said that he is bipolar while he's meeting with the president and dropping some obscenities at the other side of the Resolute desk, I'm not sure what to do with it.
I'm not either. I mean, it was quite surreal. We were actually in the newsroom working on other, what I think are arguably more important stories. So I hesitated to dig too deep on this like you, and looked up at the TV and we all sort of said, is this really happening? It was just so strange. It's hard to know what to make of it. But it is part of a litany of these kind of bizarre carnivalesque spectacles that we've seen both sometimes in the Oval Office and from the president that have the flavor more of a reality show. I mean, that seemed to remind us of the milieu that Donald Trump came out of when he ran for president. And so in that sense, I suppose it's not that surprising, but I think for a lot of people, there's a sense that it almost diminishes the office of the president to see this sort of rambling, bizarre, what do we make of it behavior from a celebrity that has been outspoken about his politics, and that's his right, but has also left many people scratching his head about what is he actually doing and is there something wrong with him? It was just a very strange moment. And I know for me and my colleagues, we just tried to move past it as quickly as we could.
Yeah, in the interest of moving past it as quickly as we could, we'll do that too. But I should note that Kanye's old nemesis Taylor Swift inserted herself into politics this week. She endorsed Democrats Phil Bredesen for Senate and Jim Cooper for the House in her home state of Tennessee on social media. The Senate race in Tennessee is tight, and Bredesen has strong support. Taylor Swift has 112 million followers on Instagram, and voter registrations among young people rose by more than 60,000 after her post. Shane Harris, let me stick with you for a moment, because President Trump is facing another difficult situation regarding the disappearance of a journalist named Jamal Khashoggi. He's a Saudi dissident and a resident of the U.S. He disappeared inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey. You've been doing a fair bit of reporting on this, particularly the concern that the Turks have raised that the Saudis basically sent hitmen to kill Jamal Khashoggi because of his reporting. The Turkish government hasn't really provided any independent evidence for this. They say they have security video and logs of people who signed in and so forth. What do we actually know right now, if anything, about what really happened?
Right. Well, what we know right now is largely coming from the Turks and Turkish security agencies. What we reported last night, my colleagues and I in the Post late last night, was that the Turks have told the Americans that they actually have audio recordings and video from inside the consulate that they say definitively proves that Jamal Khashoggi, who was an opinion writer for the Post, the Washington Post, was beaten, tortured, killed, and ultimately dismembered inside that facility. The Americans, that we understand, have not seen the footage or heard it themselves, but there is a growing belief within the U.S. intelligence community and I think within Congress and the White House that the Saudis probably did kill Jamal Khashoggi and are not at all being forthcoming about that. This is a politically difficult situation for this president in particular because the White House is so close to the regime in Saudi Arabia. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, is actually very personally close to a man named Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And I broke a story earlier this week that before Jamal Khashoggi went missing, bin Salman had actually ordered an operation to try and lure him back, perhaps under false pretenses, to Saudi Arabia where he could be detained. Khashoggi's been very critical of Mohammed bin Salman. So this looks to be like potentially a kidnapping gone wrong in Istanbul. It's not clear whether Mohammed bin Salman ordered this killing. He seems clearly to have tried to order a way to get Khashoggi back. But this is a politically very fraught and dicey moment for the White House. And of course, it has lots to say that we could talk about as well about press freedom, both in the United States and in Saudi Arabia.
Lily?
Real quick, the tech industry here in Silicon Valley is watching this closely also because there is a lot of Saudi money sloshing around in technology companies here. Just yesterday, you had the CEO of Uber, huge figure, Dara Khosrowshahi, pulling out of a gathering that's often referred to as Davos in the desert because of this. So I think he's really putting his money where his mouth is and doing so at a time when Uber has taken in billions of dollars in direct money from the Saudis.
Dara Khosrowshahi, he's Iranian, I think. Born in Tehran, I believe.
I don't know if he was born in Tehran. He is Iranian-American.
Todd, can you say a quick word about the kind of position this puts the U.S. in? I mean, the U.S. does have a fair amount of dealings with Saudi Arabia right now, including military dealings.
A lot of dealings. And when you saw the president's response yesterday in the Oval Office to reporters' questions about this, the president said, "I don't like it. I don't like it one bit." It appears Jamal Khashoggi went in the embassy and then never came out, and then pivoted right away to point out that Khashoggi was not an American citizen, which seems to have a subtext of maybe not my problem, and then pointed out the $110 billion that Saudi Arabia is spending on American weapons deals. Went as far as to say, do you want that money going to great American companies like Raytheon and McDonnell Douglas and Boeing, or do you want them going to China? This was the president's thinking over how the United States should react to the probable murder of an American resident and a journalist. And I will point out as well, this conference that Lily mentioned, the Saudi-sponsored economic development conference, media co-sponsors, American media companies, including CNN, CNBC, others have all pulled out of this conference. Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, as of right now, is still going. The Trump administration is still in. They're still all in for MBS, for Mohammed bin Salman, and they are not pulling out, basically showing their support. And the president's statement, while saying he's concerned about it, has presidential concern, made it very, very clear, I'm afraid to say, that he really doesn't.
Can't come to California without talking a little bit about California politics. And so, Lily, let me camp out with you for a bit. You spent some time in California's Central Valley, that corridor that runs on either side of Interstate 5, talking to people about the upcoming elections. Here is a clip from Bill Pine in Visalia, California. Listen.
Well, it's been at least a long time since I've seen such negative campaigning on both sides. And whether it's Republican or Democratic, I just wish people would be more positive about saying what their ambition is or what they plan to do as a politician instead of just trying to discredit the opponent.
That's Bill Pine in Visalia, California, closer to Highway 99, further east inland from Interstate 5. What else did you hear from voters in the area? Visalia is a GOP stronghold.
It is, and this is actually the district that's held currently by a guy you might have heard of, Devin Nunes. Bill Pine is a longtime supporter of Devin Nunes. He was actually on his way to a Nunes campaign event. Nunes was appearing with Jason Chaffetz, a former congressman from Utah, now a Fox News personality, to try and raise some campaign funds. And I was struck by what Bill said to me, because he said at one point, "I've gotten to the point where I don't believe anyone anymore." And that was really reflective of what I saw across that district. You know, there's deep distrust, frankly, in the national media. It was challenging to kind of do that icebreaker to talk to people, because they were like, "Where are you from?" And they've been approached by, you know, multiple national
outlets.
Probably
everybody, yeah.
And, you know, it was a case where you got to go there. And, you know, I show up at his high school and ended up talking to his ag teacher for about 20 minutes. And he told me that multiple outlets had tried to contact him, and he always says no, for the most part. So you see a real wariness. And this is a district that has a lot of serious issues. We're talking about high levels of poverty, high levels of illiteracy, and water contamination. I think there is a sense that Devin Nunes has gotten somewhat distracted by all this Russia stuff, or the Russia conspiracy, as one person put it. And, you know, is that taking some of his focus and attention away from local issues? Quite possibly.
KQED had a big coup this week hosting California's one and only debate between the two major party candidates, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and Republican rival John Cox. Just briefly, Lily, any major takeaways? I mean, Gavin Newsom has kind of been angling for this job for a long, long time.
A long time, as you know well from having spent some time here yourself. The key issue here, I think, is really going to be housing. They spent a lot of time talking about that in this debate. Everyone agrees that the situation is bad. You know, people are leaving California, and where are they going? They're going to places like Texas and Arizona, Oregon, places where the cost of living is lower. The housing affordability issue has hit a lot of people here very hard. Cox, John Cox, the Republican in this race, is trying to play up his role as a home builder for many years. He's a businessman from San Diego. He says, you know, in his own experience, he's seen how expensive it is to build new housing here. The approval times can go on for years. He compares, you know, building a unit in Indiana, you need 6 months, versus here it can take up to 15 years. He was a little vague, admittedly, on how he plans to address that. Newsom, for his part, is talking about how the state doesn't have specific objectives and timelines in place. And so the criticism Cox leveled at him was, well, you've been in office for 16 years. You know, where have you been on this all this time? First as mayor of San Francisco and then as lieutenant governor. You know, Trump looms large in this race, but he's not you know, mentioned a whole lot. In fact, Cox never said the word Trump during the debate that was held in the studio right next to us. He did get Trump's endorsement, and they do have some alignment on particular issues like the border wall and sanctuary law.
Lily Jamali, co-host and correspondent for the California Report here at KQED. Lily, thanks for talking to us. Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Joshua.
And political journalist and radio host Todd Zwillick. Thanks, Todd.
A pleasure. Thanks, Joshua.
Coming up, we'll dive into the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from U.S. Army Medicine, one of the nation's innovative medical institutions that puts healthcare professionals at the forefront of medicine. U.S. Army Medicine is an elite team pioneering new medical discoveries to make a difference in the lives of Americans. Army Medicine is your chance to push medicine further. Learn more at goarmy.com/amed.
Hey, y'all. I'm Sam Sanders. I host an NPR show called It's Been a Minute. Every Friday on the show, I talk out the week of news, because sometimes the best way to process everything going on right now is through good conversation. Download the show, and we'll process everything together.
Authorities in Turkey might have audio and visual evidence proving that a dissident Saudi journalist was killed inside the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul. The U.S. has joined an investigation into the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident and a Washington Post columnist. Also, America's ambassador to the UN announced this week that she will leave the administration at the end of the year. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took another stab at persuading North Korea to disarm its nuclear weapons. Brazil will hold a runoff election to determine its next president. And India's Bollywood experienced its own Me Too moment and the fallout that comes with it. Joining us from our home base in Washington for the Friday News Roundup is John Sopel, North America editor for the BBC and the author of If Only They Didn't Speak English, Notes from Trump's America. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in D.C. is Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And Uri Friedman, a staff writer at The Atlantic covering global affairs. Uri, glad to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
We're also pleased to get your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories from around the world. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream or tweet us at 1A. The U.S. representative to the U.N. is stepping down. President Trump accepted the resignation of America's ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, on Tuesday. Here is some of what she had to say during the announcement at the White House.
Look at the 2 years. Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through. And the president proved that, whether it was with the chemical weapons in Syria, whether it's with NATO, saying that other countries have to pay their share. I mean, whether it's the trade deals, which have been amazing, they get that the president means business, and they follow through with that.
That's Nikki Haley speaking on Tuesday at the White House, announcing that she would resign as U.S. ambassador to the U.N., reportedly at the end of the year. Nancy Youssef, let me start with you. What was your read on her reputation internationally in terms of the way that she represented the U.S. to the world on a diplomatic level?
Well, I think she personified for the world community the idea of the America First sort of slogan that the Trump administration came in with. And we heard that really from the onset of her arrival there. And she was making that message to the world community daily on issues like North Korea, on the Palestinian issue. And so while Trump had sort of created the rhetoric, she created the sort of measures that sort of signaled to the world that the United States wasn't just talking rhetorically, but was acting in its sanctions policy, in its stance on issues like the Paris Peace Accord and others, that it was moving towards that direction. And I think because of her personality and the sort of the way that she sort of captured the attention at the UN and spoke so forcefully and at the same time seemed to be a close confidant of the president, she really sort of delivered this idea to the world community of America First. And you started to see under her tenure a world community sort of adjusting on that message and not presuming that it's just rhetoric, but actually the foundations of U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration.
John Sopel, what's your read of Nikki Haley's reputation, particularly because at times she was a fairly fierce defender of the White House's international agenda, but at other times she was not afraid to differ?
Exactly. She was Trumpian without being Trump. And I think that the international community found her a kind of reassuring figure who could translate some of Donald Trump's impulses and urges to do things into kind of more rational, thought out argument. And for that reason, I think that they found her a figure of reassurance. I think when she was a good communicator. I mean, you know, when she took on the Russian ambassador and she had the picture of the children who had been gassed in a chemical weapons attack in Syria, I think the rest of the international community thought she was highly effective in what she was doing. And I suspect they will miss her because what you always worry is that maybe you're going to end up with somebody who is even less internationalist, less kind of globalist in the kind of UN sense of it, and therefore maybe a more difficult person to deal with.
Well, Uri Friedman, that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, particularly the tone of Nikki Haley compared to some of America's other leaders on the world stage. I mean, you have Mike Pompeo as the Secretary of State, who's a little more hawkish than his predecessor, Rex Tillerson. You have John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, who is definitely not shy about his view of the world and what America's foreign policy should be. What's our thought, so far anyway, about who or what might be next in terms of America's presence on the UN? Would it be someone who is a little more in line with John Bolton and Mike Pompeo in terms of being more hawkish and more forward, or someone in line more like Nikki Haley?
Yeah, I would bet on someone who is more in line with Donald Trump's America First vision. We don't know that. There have been a number of names floated. One name was Dina Powell, who formerly served on his National Security Council. Now that's being batted down. And there was some criticism that she was too much of, you know, in Trump's derogatory term, a globalist. One thing that was striking about Nikki Haley, as John mentioned, sometimes she was Trumpian without being Trump. Sometimes she wasn't even Trumpian, right? She would actually be a check on the president on things like Russia, being more aggressive on Russia, talking about human rights, which almost no one else in the administration did. And one thing that I've noticed is that over time, as Donald Trump has settled into the presidency, he started to surround himself with people who will more, even if they don't believe exactly, even if they aren't true believers in his America First vision, are at least going to help enable his agenda as opposed to serving as a check or obstructing his agenda. That's what we've seen with Mike Pompeo versus Rex Tillerson. That's what we've seen with John Bolton versus H.R. McMaster. So I would assume that who may follow Nikki Haley will be someone who is more of a true believer, or at least more willing to enable the agenda rather than stand up to the president. And that will have implications for U.S. policy at the United Nations.
And Uri, since that term gets thrown around so much, and it's not always meant as a compliment, when we say someone is a globalist, what are we talking about with that term? Like, what's the code underlying that?
Yeah, the idea, you know, the way Trump supporters use it in a derogatory fashion is that people are concerned about global interests and forgetting about the primacy of the national interests. They're, you know, what Donald Trump often says is he wants to stop looking out for the world and start looking out for America. And then the feeling is that if you're a globalist, you don't have America's national sovereignty, national interests in mind. But, you know, defenders of that would say America is the leader of the world. We are trying to help create an international system in which, you know, human rights are championed and there's stability and we prevent conflict and all of these things. And we have to think that in our current 21st century world, things like climate change are not just, you know, an issue for the United States. They're an issue for the world. There are transnational issues that everyone needs to care about. And we have to have a more internationalist mindset and a mindset of working with other countries in order to solve problems that don't just affect us, but affect all lots of other countries. So that is the pro-globalist mindset. But it has really become a word term that has been more tarnished in the Trump administration, as people have argued that we've spent too much time being international minded and not enough time being national minded.
One big story that has captivated the world's attention this week has to do with a respected Saudi Arabian journalist. He recently became a critic of the Saudi regime, and he disappeared inside his country's consulate in Turkey. Turkish officials have spoken of murder, maybe dismemberment, at the hands of Saudi agents. His name is Jamal Khashoggi. Nancy Youssef, give us a sense of who Jamal Khashoggi is and why he was seen as a threat or a thorn in the side of the Saudi regime.
So Jamal Khashoggi was a longtime journalist and covered Saudi issues. Before that, he was actually a royal advisor to the Saudi regime. He has been a journalist since the 1980s. He interviewed bin Laden. He also came from one of the more prominent Saudi families. And so he was really a national figure and arguably a regional one. He had nearly 2 million followers on Twitter. And so he was probably one of the most prominent names in journalism. And what was interesting about him is he really tried to walk this threat a very thin line, where he sort of called for reforms in Saudi Arabia, but also called for inclusions of groups that they consider an existential threat to them, like the Muslim Brotherhood. And so over the years, particularly post-Arab Spring, when these issues had become so polarizing, he came under increased attack by the regime, some of whom sort of were taken aback that someone who had once been in their circle was now criticizing him. And in the last year, he went on a self-imposed exile here in Washington and started writing columns for the Washington Post. He had two audiences, the Saudis, Saudi people, and the Americans. And he was really trying to be a voice for reforms in the Middle East against these sort of decade-long rules that he saw as sort of undermining progress in the region. And so he was a very well-known figure in Washington. He was a known figure in the region, and controversial maybe not simply because of what he wrote, but because of the impact of his writings across the region at a time when it's so divisive about whether one can support outside groups and regimes that feel deeply threatened by the threat of another Arab Spring-like uprising.
Chess1643 wrote on our website, the1a.org, there is no reason to maintain close ties with a country that beheads more people than ISIS, finally gives women the right to drive, but it's only window dressing, is killing civilians in Yemen, and murdered a journalist who is critical of the royal family, and royal is in quotation marks. If I were king for a day, all the weapons we've sold them would be rendered useless, and Jared Kushner would be banned from any policymaking. John Sopel, we've heard a number of accounts, particularly from the Turks, about what Saudi Arabia allegedly did to Mr. Khashoggi, that they basically sent hitmen after him. What do we know for sure about the disappearance at this point?
For sure, we know that he walked into the consul in Istanbul and he didn't walk out. That is what we know for sure. There are then reports that there were two Gulfstream jets that came from Saudi Arabia with 15 men. They got into blacked out vans, drove to the consul general's residence, which is allegedly where Khashoggi may have been taken. And they did what they did to him. Now, there are reports circulating that Turkish intelligence have proof that they know what happened to him and that he was tortured and dismembered and met the most brutal of brutal deaths, and that the 15 men then flew back to Saudi Arabia on their Gulfstream jets a little later in the day. Now, we know that the planes, there were those two plane movements at different times that came into Istanbul airport and then went back to Riyadh. Who was on them? What their designation was within the state apparatus, we don't 100% know. But you get the distinct sense that that what the Turkish are telling the authorities here and what the authorities here in the US understand is not a million miles from what I have just sketched out. Because I think that there has been a willingness to believe, and that is why you're seeing the deep expressions of anxiety and unease over what has unfolded and over what the implications might be. There are some things that you can easily sweep under the carpet in international affairs, and there are some things that are just are a bit more awkward, and this definitely falls into the latter category.
Uri, I wonder if we could talk about the U.S. and Saudi Arabia's relationship. They're very long-time allies. At a press conference at the Oval Office yesterday, President Trump was asked about Khashoggi's disappearance. Here's part of what the president said.
First, I want to find out what happened, and we're looking. Again, this took place in Turkey, and to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a United States citizen. Is that right? Or is that right? He's a permanent resident. Okay. We don't like it, John. We don't like it, and we don't like it even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing they have four or five alternatives, two very good alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me. Okay, but we're looking for the answer, and I think probably you'll have an answer sooner than people think.
It's the president speaking at the Oval Office yesterday, and when he was referring to they, he meant Saudi Arabia, and the four or five alternatives would be other countries from whom the Saudis could buy arms. The $110 billion is an arms deal, a military deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Uri, I wonder if you could give us your sense of how this case fits into the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, especially in light of the comment that I read earlier. I'll reread it. Chess1643 wrote on our website, the1a.org, there is no reason to maintain close ties with a country that beheads more people than ISIS, finally gives women the right to drive, but it's only window dressing, is killing civilians in Yemen, and murdered a journalist who was critical of the quote-unquote royal family. If I were king for a day, all the weapons we've sold them would be rendered useless, and Jared Kushner would be banned from any policymaking. lot of sharp elbows thrown in that comment. I wonder if you could help us fact check that.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating point. And also that clip you played of Donald Trump was really striking, because on the one hand, it seemed so coldly transactional, in the sense that he was saying, you know, we have billions of dollars pouring in. Why am I going to stop that just because they have murdered a dissident journalist? In other words, I don't care about human rights, something we usually stand up for. I care about money pouring into the United States economy. And that attitude has activated a lot of people in Washington who are against our alliance with Saudi Arabia. For example, senators on both sides of the aisle, like Chris Murphy and Rand Paul, who've been arguing for a long time, just as the commenter said, that we are supporting a war in Yemen that is unconscionable, that is starving civilians and killing civilians in, you know, bus attacks and other things that are just horrendous.
Sorry to cut you short, but since you mentioned Rand Paul, I'm really sorry to interrupt you, but we have a clip of Rand Paul speaking to a reporter this week on that very thing. He said he would try to force a vote on U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. I'll let you finish your thought, but first let's hear from Senator Paul.
I think that the early reports have shown that this is linked to the Saudi government, and nothing happens in Saudi Arabia without the government's approval. So, no, I think that unless all of a sudden the journalist turns up alive, I think that we should discontinue our arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Plus, I think we need to be voting in the Senate and debating whether or not we should be involved in the war in Yemen.
That was Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Uri, go ahead.
So I was going to say, people like Rand Paul are going to push back against arms sales, about our support for the war in Yemen. You even saw lawmakers invoking the Global Magnitsky Act, which says that the U.S. Trump administration has to investigate what happened, and if they find Saudi officials responsible, they need to impose sanctions. All that being said, there's a counterpoint to this, too, which is that our relationship with Saudi Arabia has always been transactional. Trump kind of said the quiet part out loud a little bit in the way he framed it yesterday, because we have never had a relationship and alliance based on values. Since World War II, it has all been about money and oil. Think about 9/11. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. That didn't lead to a permanent rupture in our alliance, because we have always seen them as a strategic ally, not as a values-based ally as in Europe. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that Trump said it in a particular accentuated way, and he feels, you know, is very transactional way past presidents have. But this is somewhat reflective of what U.S. Presidents have said quietly for a long time.
Yeah, Joshua, if I could chip in there, that's exactly mm-hmm. it. I mean, I think Donald Trump said out loud what other presidents and other prime ministers have said at awkward moments in relationships you have with regimes that are far from perfect. I mean, I remember when Tony Blair was prime minister, and there was a huge arms deal that was about to be concluded, and the British Serious Fraud Office launched an investigation into what Saudi Arabia had been doing, and whether they'd been paying kickbacks or whatever to get contracts through. And you know, it was clear that the Saudis had said to Blair, "You've got to call off the dogs, otherwise the deal is in jeopardy." And highly unusually, massively controversially, Tony Blair intervened with an independent investigation and said, "Right, we're cancelling this investigation." And he used his power as prime minister because he felt he had to, because Saudi Arabia was too big a customer, too important an ally. And you've seen with Donald Trump, you know, one of the first places he went to when he became president was to Saudi Arabia. I traveled with him on that trip, and they were 100% in with Mohammed bin Salman. Now, whether they're regretting that or not is an open question. However, they are there, and Donald Trump is determined that the arms deal will go ahead.
Joshua, before we keep moving, go ahead, Nancy.
I was just going to say, if I could just add one thing that struck mm-hmm. me is what the president didn't say. He didn't mention Iran, and he didn't mention the peace deal. And as you recall, last month at the UN, the United States was pretty aggressive in calling Iran the biggest threat to the region, and by extension, it was seeing Saudi Arabia as that stopgap against possible Iranian expansion across the Middle East. And of course, Saudi Arabia would be key to any sort of peace deal. So I think it's interesting that a month ago we were talking about policies and going against Iran. And so going forward, how much will the U.S. focus on Iran and stopping an Iranian expansion shape its reaction or lack thereof to what's happened in Saudi Arabia, and if it in fact is the case that they have killed a journalist inside their consulate who was a resident of the United States.
Speaking of journalists who have been killed, there's another journalist being remembered today in Bulgaria at a funeral. The body of 30-year-old TV host Victoria Marinova was found over the weekend near the Danube River in a northern Bulgarian town. She had been raped and strangled. Uri, apparently German authorities have arrested a suspect in this case. Do we know anything more about it, particularly whether her death was connected to her reporting?
Yeah, there's kind of a battle of interpretation over that. So the Bulgarian authorities are saying, no, it wasn't. This was a spontaneous act by someone, they say, was wanted for another rape and murder. So this is someone with a criminal background. There are others, though, who argue that one, the authorities were too quick to say this wasn't a contract killing before knowing all the facts, which raises suspicions. And then two, I think people are just really primed at the moment to see things as retaliation against journalists because we're in a very bad climate for journalists right now. And actually, in Marinova's final broadcast, she had interviewed two investigative journalists who were looking at government corruption. And so that raises questions, too. So we don't know. And even if it was, not related at all to her work, it's important to know that there are reasons atmospherically for this suspicion. You know, Bulgaria is ranked 111th in press freedom in the world, the lowest for any EU member state. So this is a country where there is not a lot of press freedom, where in broader, if you zoom out from Bulgaria, in Europe and around the world, where press and the journalists are under attack, whether it's calling fake news or actually intimidating journalists and trying to suppress the free press as countries become more authoritarian. So I think that this is representative of that, whether or not she was targeted specifically for the work she had done on corruption.
And John, we should also note that in other news about media, there's a blogger turned investigator who seems to be going head to head with British intelligence in sussing out facts about the poisoning attack on Sergei Skripal, that former Russian spy, and his daughter. Can you tell us briefly, John, about this guy, Elliot Higgins, and what he says he discovered about the suspects?
Well, it has been the most extraordinary research that has been done. I don't know whether it's going head to head. It's kind of complementing the work of the British security services. And I think they're sitting back and kind of rubbing their hands with some glee at the discomfort that the Russian Secret Service, the GRU, is being put through over this. Because, you know, we know that there was a chemical weapon attack on two people living in Salisbury in Wiltshire, about kind of 80 or 90 miles southwest of London. And they used Novichok, a nerve agent, to try to kill these two people. Someone else subsequently died from it, but not those two. And there was an investigation, and the police kind of did the most amazing job with CCTV cameras, of which there are very many in the UK, and they charted these guys that when they arrived from Moscow, their journey down to Salisbury, the wrecking of everything, and then going back again. But this Bellingcat website has identified them through a mixture of getting access to kind of insurance details of the cars that they insured and all the rest of them. But we now have a full identity of the two people. I think the important point to make here, Joshua, is do we think that this was just utterly stupid spycraft on the part of these Russians and that they are kind of comedy caper idiots who didn't know what they were doing? Or do the Russians not care? Is this a message that you send out to would-be double agents around the world? We will come after you and we will give you the most painful death imaginable.
A number of stories out of Asia this week. Let's start with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his tour of Asia. The secretary made a number of stops, including a lunch meeting with Kim Jong-un on Sunday in Pyongyang, North Korea. President Trump tweeted about that meeting, writing, quote, "At Sec Pompeo, had a good meeting with Chairman Kim today in Pyongyang." He also wrote, "Progress made on Singapore summit agreements. I look forward to seeing Chairman Kim again in the near future." Nancy, Secretary Pompeo also reported positive steps forward being set from this visit. One of the big items would be that North Korea said it would allow international inspectors into a missile testing facility. Where does this latest meeting place us in terms of the effort to denuclearize North Korea?
Well, it's unclear. Those inspectors, we don't know who those inspectors would be and where they would be from. There are two sites that the North Koreans have repeatedly made reference to, a nuclear test site and a missile test site that they are prepared to destroy, that they destroyed tunnels in the former and the launch pad for the latter. And so one could interpret that the North Koreans are really trying to get as much mileage out of their decision to do that without having to make any more concessions as they seek another summit with the president, because from their perspective, that summit builds on its nation's legitimacy. And so we heard a lot of talk about progress, but none of those key questions have been answered. Who would do those inspections? When are we going to get an inventory of their nuclear program and compare it essentially with the U.S. one? What would sort of a peace declaration for the end of the war look like, and at what cost? And so we're at, one could argue, at the stasis where one can't agree. There's an agreement that things need to be forward, but the specifics that actually get you towards progress, such that the U.S. feels that it is getting something for what it's done so far, beyond the North Korean promise to destroy these sites and let some unnamed inspectors see it.
The U.S. has also been putting some pressure on an increasingly tense relationship with China. Department of Justice officials said on Wednesday that a Chinese spy was arrested and extradited to the U.S. to face charges. This will be the very first time that a Chinese intelligence official will be prosecuted and tried in open court. U.S. lawmakers are also weighing in to add pressure on China regarding human rights abuses. The Congressional Executive Commission on China put out its annual rights report. It unveiled a bill to condemn the treatment of Uyghur immigrants in China. Uri Friedman, I wonder whether these two efforts, the extradition of the Chinese spy and calling out China for its treatment of Uyghur immigrants, what that amounts to.
Yeah, I think they're related in the sense that the Trump administration is really launching a broad challenge to China at the moment on every front. I mean, whether it's a multi-billion dollar trade war or cracking down on spycraft, you know, this isn't the only case. Yes, it's the first case in the U.S. where the Chinese intelligence official will face open trial, but this is not going to be the only case in which they are doing that. Many suspects remain at large. And then also you saw last week Mike Pence, the vice president, give a speech, and basically he like threw down the gauntlet. He said, you know, this is a great power rivalry. And I was struck by something that John Bolton, Donald Trump's national security advisor, said right before the United Nations General Assembly, when he said, I don't think people understand what's at stake here. This isn't about like getting a better trade deficit terms with China and addressing the trade deficit. This is about power. China's economic power, whether they're stealing our trade secrets or importing more than, exporting more than importing, when they get more economic power, they get more military power. And this is really about a rising China and a ruling United States confronting each other in a way that might have happened under Hillary Clinton or anyone else, but is particularly acute at the moment between Xi Jinping, who is being much more assertive on the world stage, and Donald Trump, who has said for a long time he's not going to tolerate this anymore, that we have built up China at America's expense. And so I think whether it's through the lens of human rights or through the lens of cracking down on Chinese tradecraft, we're saying no more. We're not going to tolerate this anymore.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay close.
What happens when a family decides to adopt a child of a different race?
All of my life, my parents have told me I'm just like my brother and sisters. But I wasn't, and I'm not.
This week on Code Switch, transracial adoptees speak for themselves.
The story of the ex-president of Interpol, Meng Hongwei, who was reported missing last week by his wife, that story has moved. Meng was detained by Chinese authorities on corruption charges. He resigned in immediate effect this week. The arrest is part of a larger official anti-corruption campaign by China's President Xi Jinping. Now, Grace Meng, the ex-Interpol president's wife, is speaking out. She told the Associated Press that she felt threatened. Nancy Youssef, do we have a sense that, of why this is going on, of what it is that makes Meng so important to the Chinese government, or what this means in a larger sense?
Well, he's been a long-time operative of the Chinese government, and there are arguments being made that this is part of an effort to purge non-loyalists to the Xi government. And so there's no definitive answer, but I think the message that many are taking is if somebody who's been in government this long in a police capacity could be swept off the streets, and his wife sent a knife emoji the day he disappears, that no one in China is safe. And at the time of all this, there was talk from party officials about the importance of absolute loyalty. So their suggestion certainly is that somehow he was less than loyal in the eyes of the government. I will say I think one of the more interesting developments as well is his wife and how outspoken she has been. She has been she's in French protective custody, but she's been speaking out in a way that we wouldn't normally see out of China. And I thought it was an interesting development and may have led to more information coming out quicker than Chinese officials wanted to happen. And so it was fascinating to watch her sort of use the public platform in a way we'd see more often in the West as a way to get information about her husband and defend her husband. It's something we don't normally see.
Let's head now to Brazil, where far-right presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro surprised the nation when he shot to the top of the ranks. He nearly took the election with 46% of the vote, just shy of preventing a runoff. Brazilians will vote in their runoff election soon, on October 28th. Ori Friedman, can you remind us who Jair Bolsonaro is and what makes him and his policy platform so newsworthy?
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. He's a former army captain. He's been in Congress for almost 3 decades. He is a law and order candidate. That is his big thing. So he says, you know, our crime rates are too high. We need to empower the police. He is very controversial in saying, you know, the police need to shoot first. Shoot to kill, and also to loosen gun laws to address crime rates. He's also very controversial in the sense that he said things that are misogynistic, that are anti-LGBT. And one other thing that's really important is, so Brazil, we often forget, only became a democracy in 1985, or returned to democracy in 1985. For 21 years, it had a dictatorship, and he has spoken nostalgically about the time of the dictatorship as a time when there was law and order. One other point to note is that he is enamored with Donald Trump. A lot of conservatives feel that Donald Trump has the right formula: be pro-business, you know, loosen regulations, you know, be nationalistic, and be about cracking down on crime. And he has promised to be a really close ally of the United States. All of this is very shocking because Brazil, for decades, has been led by a leftist government that was a little more ambivalent about its relationship with the United States, and certainly didn't espouse kind of the right-wing views that he espouses. So this was a real shock to the system. I think it really goes to the fact that Brazil, I mean, it's in deep recession. It's embroiled in a massive corruption crisis that affected all parties except for Bolsonaro, who has actually not been implicated in this. And that was his winning point. And I'll say one other thing. The Atlantic read an article in which they interviewed a cab driver who said, you know, things are so bad, maybe we need someone with crazy ideas. Who else is going to fix this mess? And so I think that is a sentiment that is worth keeping an eye on, because that was a similar sentiment in Brexit, in Donald Trump's victory, in the victory of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico. I mean, this is a sentiment that people are feeling against the establishment right in many countries of the world.
Glad to hear from some Brazilians who are listening in today and looking ahead to the election. One listener emailed, "I'm Anna, a Brazilian listening from a city next to Brazil's capital, Brasilia. I'm very concerned about the future of our democracy. The candidate leading the polls is an ex-military who has a very anti-democratic discourse, which is also racist, misogynist, and homophobic. Since last Sunday, the election day, more than 50 people have suffered physical and verbal aggressions from Bolsonaro supporters. Social media, specifically WhatsApp, is playing a very important role, and lots of fake news is circulating. I really believe that with Bolsonaro, our democracy is at risk." John Sopel, what's projected to happen for the runoff? Is there any sense of whether Bolsonaro could win this?
Well, the last poll I saw suggested yes, that the latest poll suggests that he is at 58% and the opposition leader is at 42%, Fernando Haddad. And so I kind of think that you'd have to say that it's with that sort of margin of error, it's going to take something for the leftist kind of candidate to come back from that position. I mean, you know, they talk about violence. And the other thing about Bolsonaro is that he was stabbed in September at a rally. So there's been a lot of violence all round. But it has meant that he has been able to say, I'd love to take part in debates, but I really can't at the moment because I'm still, you know, slightly getting over the stabbing that I had then. So I'm afraid I won't be able to come to your studio this evening. And so I think that there is kind of a feeling that, you know, he's got his head down. He has said what he has said. People know exactly where he stands. And I think he sees the finish line.
One story that much of the world has been talking about has to do with a new report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. The report says that the world is quickly running out of time to stem catastrophic climate change. Scientists predict we are on course to go beyond a crucial threshold of the world's average temperature rising 1.5 degrees Celsius, or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, in just over about 10 years. They say that would leave us dealing with the risks of extreme drought, wildfires, floods, food shortages for hundreds of millions of people. We talked about this report on the program this week. One comment from a listener stuck along the lines that at least here in America, this is just not a big enough issue. I mean, people vote for a lot of reasons, and the state of our climate is not something that lawmakers talk much about or that voters demand to discuss. Nancy Youssef, what is your sense of that, of whether or not this report has made an impact around the world enough for people to start demanding action?
I think it's made an impact, but the problem is the effects of this already being seen in various ways around the world. So where one country could say it's not a big impact, another country could see it as an immediate impact and something that needs to be dealt with aggressively. And of course, the kinds of changes that this report says need to happen are so drastic that it demands sort of a uniform world agreed upon action, and we're not there yet. And so you're seeing a variance in response, and I think it really reflects the variance of impact that nations are already seeing. And you know, as a war correspondent, one of the things I see it come up most often is as a cause of the start of wars and conflicts, environmental changes, changing where people live, how they're able to eat. So it's an area that doesn't just hit the environment, but really hits other parts of national security and government writ large. But there's, because of the complexity in terms of its impact, I think it's hard to get a uniform agreement, particularly in such a polarized time. So it's hard to be optimistic that we'll see, at least in the short term, the kinds of drastic changes that this report says needs to happen to stop literally famine, drought, wildfires, really severe consequences.
Joshua, I was in Europe at the beginning of the week, and when the report came out, and our main national news shows, kind of half an hour long, so the same as the nightly news programs here, the first 6-7 minutes were devoted to this IPCC report. I wonder how much was devoted. I mean, that's one of the things that really strikes me about living here compared in America, where you get more weather, I think, per square inch than any other kind of country on the planet. You talk a huge amount about weather, but climate is not discussed. And that is one of the things that really strikes me. Whereas I think in Europe, there's a much greater consciousness. Whether they're doing that much about it is another issue. But I think that, you know, I am struck by how little this commands the national debate compared to in other parts of the world.
And Joshua, I just add one thing to that. I spoke with the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, recently, right before the UN General Assembly. And I asked him, what is the greatest threat you face right now? What is your greatest challenge? I expected him to say, avoiding a disruption with the United States or the conflict in Syria. He said climate change. He said, this is the existential question of our time. This is what I'm focusing my most energy on. Conflicts you can try to solve, you can always solve. If we don't stop this in the next few years, it becomes irreversible damage. And that is what he's devoting most of his attention to. You know, I thought he is one of the people, I thought of this report as almost the UN standing at an intersection and gesturing wildly to go in one direction. And the world in a convoy of cars is zooming 70 miles per hour in the other direction. You know, we are moving not in the direction of what this report recommends. And they are saying we need to take action immediately.
Yeah, the reaction from some international lawmakers has been pretty muted. This is environmental campaigner George Monbiot. He gave his take on why politicians seem reluctant to speak out on this.
You know, they just want the issue to go away so people stop talking about it. That's all they want, because it just messes up everything. You know, all their nice cozy relationships with corporations, all their five-year plans, everything just goes by the wayside because it does just question all the premises on which our politics and economics has been created.
That's environmental campaigner George Monbiot. Would be worth noting that we did have a longer conversation about this report earlier in the week. You'll find that on our website, the1a.org. It is the world's biggest film industry. It makes millions of dollars, many millions of dollars, but Bollywood has stayed pretty much silent on the Me Too movement, until now. This week, Tanushree Dutta went public and filed a police complaint against a film star named Narna Partika. Dutta says he insisted that intimate dance steps were included in a song for a movie they were working together on. The former Miss India Universe told the BBC it was, quote, really creepy because he had to put his hands all over me, unquote. She says she was labeled unprofessional and called a crazy drama queen. Narna Partika denies the allegations. I wonder, Nancy, what's our take on this? The Me Too movement not only reaching Hollywood, but also Bollywood.
It was striking to me reading the developments in the last few weeks, how universal the questions are that are around this across cultures in terms of what constitutes sexual harassment, what constitutes sexual assault, what is appropriate, what isn't appropriate, and what repercussions, what are sort of the mechanisms in terms of determining what should happen should someone violate someone in this way. And there was just such a universality in the language and the questions that were coming out of India. And the other interesting thing to me is that this was started by one actor is bringing a complaint, and all of a sudden it opened the floodgates for other people coming forward, much like this country. So it was, to me, a real eye-opener in terms of how this issue isn't defined so much by country or culture, but by a shared experience across the world. And for me, this was a real eye-opener about to that point.
Let's get to a little reporting from the BBC from this year in Mumbai. Reporter Rajini Viyad Anarthan did speak to several Bollywood actresses about Me Too. Here's how one woman described her experience with a film director.
He just said bluntly, okay, see, I like you, you know that, but I need this sexual relation with you. And I said, no, that you are saying no, then I'm not going to cast you in my film. And on the top of that, he cursed me. She said, no, you're not going to get any good roles and nothing good will happen to you and this and that. And I was like, I don't think you have that much power.
We should note, by the way, they're talking about very, very big celebrities that might not be household names in the U.S., but big Bollywood stars that are known to millions. John Sopel, before we move on from this, what do you think might have changed that's now given Indian women in Bollywood more confidence to speak out?
Hashtag Me Too. I mean, the hashtag Me Too has become a global phenomenon, and it doesn't matter which part of the planet you're on, people are aware of it, and people are thinking that it is my time now to speak out. And, you know, and you can see it in corporations, in organizations up across the world where the Me Too movement is having an impact. It's having an impact on the way people feel they can behave in offices and with their fellow work colleagues. And it seems to be universal, maybe slightly less so in kind of parts of this administration where it still seems that, you know, somehow you are disbelieved and, you know, you can be trashed if you come forward to make a complaint, not referencing any, of course, any appointment to the Supreme Court recently.
Two more stories that caught our attention before we go. When the First Lady of the United States is a former model, it's not unusual for the world to pay very close attention to her fashion choices. But Melania Trump drew more criticism for her travel wardrobe. In June, she took a trip to the U.S.-Mexico border wearing a jacket that said, "I don't really care, do you?" That was at the start of the current family separation crisis that left many children unaccompanied and detained by the nation's immigration process. This week, Mrs. Trump got criticism for what she wore while visiting Africa on her first solo trip abroad. The main outfit that got mocked online was an off-white pantsuit with a matching fedora. It drew comparisons to everyone from the Woody Allen character in Annie Hall to Michael Jackson in the video for Smooth Criminal to that evil Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark. John Sopel, North America editor for the BBC, Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic. Nancy, John, Uri, thanks very much for talking to us. 1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. 1A's senior team is Daniel Knight, Denise Couture, and Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Gabe Bullard. You can learn more about them online at the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.